Good afternoon. Let's go ahead and begin. This is a meeting of the Title Setting Board pursuant to Article 40 of Title I. We're picking up from our morning agenda after being in recess. The time is 1:13 p.m. The Title Board members this afternoon, again, my name is Bill Hobbs, Deputy Secretary of State. To my left is Sharon Eubanks, Deputy Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services. And then to my right is Dan Domenico, Solicitor General. I do want to emphasize, something I emphasized this morning is that we have a very full agenda, and it will be necessary to move pretty quickly. So I would ask all of us to economize with our discussions, and hopefully we can get through the agenda successfully, and it won't be too late in the evening, although I hope it's not the evening. But in any event, let's go ahead and begin with the first agenda item, which is 2007-2008, number 103, Colorado Housing Investment Fund. And we'll begin with the proponents and see if the board has any questions for the proponents. Mr. Myrie, I think you're representing proponents. If you'll introduce yourself, please.
Yes. Blaine Myrie, Isaacson Rosenbaum on behalf of the proponents.
Among other things, it might be helpful to this is somewhat similar to number 86, I believe. Perhaps if you want to talk about
correct.
That.
That's correct. It is very similar to 86. In fact, the draft title is very similar to what was initially set in 86, and so I guess probably to economize time, I'll just open it up for questions from the members.
Are there any questions?
Could you just tell us what the differences are?
The differences are twofold. One, there's no orphan provision, which caused problems with. Also, the effective date language has been, I think, improved and coherent and perfect sense of how it operates. So I think that is kind of addressed the concerns and needs.
All right, you didn't sneak anything else in there that I'm missing that's different. Thank you. Because that's what I was looking for. So I didn't see anything else, but there's a lot that I sometimes miss.
It was not the intention to sneak anything in, orphan or otherwise.
Sure.
Any other questions? If not, let's move on to the question of single subject compliance. Any discussion by the board? Is there anyone who wishes to testify on the measure concerning single subject compliance? If not, then discussion by the board. Ms. Eubanks?
Well, since there's no longer an inflation factor requirement imposed on the General Assembly, I feel that the measure constitutes a single subject, and I think we should proceed in setting the title.
Is that your motion?
I so move.
I'll second that. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Then let's turn to the staff prepared drafts. Draft that Ms. Gomez has displayed on the screen in the room. I would note that there is the Office of State Planning and Budgeting has provided a fiscal estimate of the measure. I think copies are available on the table. They also provided a revised estimate of number 86. And so, Mr. Myrie, would you like to comment on the staff draft?
Sure. The staff draft is virtually identical to the title that it was initially set for 86, which I think is good. There's a couple things that I would strike out, which I think were stricken in initial title for 86, and that is in line 3, the phrase throughout the state, I think, can be stricken to economize words. And then in line 7, the term real estate that modifies transfer tax, I think, can be removed, because I think just having the phrase transfer tax is it's already been referred to once as real estate transfer tax, so I think just saying transfer tax has complete clarity and better economy of words. And then in terms of fiscal note, the proponents set at $38.0 million, which is sort of in the middle of the range given, and it's based on the proponents' own estimates. $38 million is the most accurate number.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Murray? And again, is there anybody else who wishes to testify on the staff draft of the titles? Okay. Discussion by the board? Ms. Eubanks?
In terms of the two proposed changes, in terms of the text of the title, I would go ahead and move that on line 3, the language be stricken throughout the state.
You want a second now, or?
Sure. Awesome. Or you want to do both of them together?
Why don't you go ahead and do both?
Okay. And then on line 7, to strike real estate before transfer tax. And I would move those changes.
I'll second that. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Other changes to the staff draft? I guess I'm okay with the suggestion from Mr. Murray on behalf of proponents to use the $38.0 million in line 1. As you said, it's less than the maximum that Office of State Planning and Budgeting has estimated, and I think we've had some discussion in the past that there may be some risk for proponents if tax revenues are higher than the amount specified in the ballot title, but it's within the range of OSPB, and it apparently is within the range of that the proponents have estimated, so I'm okay with $38 million. Maybe $38.0 million? I don't know. Be consistent as to form. But if members of the board prefer a different figure, of course, that's...
This is my kind of fundamental question about these is what that number actually means, and if it means what I think it means, then I think we should put whatever the proponents want to do. If they want to raise taxes $10 annually, seems to me that's the number we put in there, and then anything over that has to be refunded under Tabor. So to me, that number really is totally up to the proponents, unless I'm misunderstanding how this language works in practice, which is certainly possible. To me, I don't think we should change it, even if we want to, for that reason, that it's really how much the proponents want to put in there is up to them.
Mr. Banks.
I'm just in agreement with Mr. Domenico in terms of what I think the purpose of having the number in there is for, and as long as the proponents are comfortable with the fact that if, by chance, the tax generates more than $38 million, that it's my understanding also that that would be required to be refunded, and as long as they're okay with that, I'm fine with that also.
Well, I'll move the change that inserts $38.0 million in line 1.
Second.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Further changes to the staff draft? I'd like to ask about, in line 4, the 4 cents for each $100. I wonder if, to me, that's kind of hard to read. I wonder if it would be helpful to write out 4 cents in words. I think I might prefer it, but I just don't know whether there's any support for that. Mr. Meyer, do you have any concern? I guess I'll go ahead and move then that in line 4 we strike $.04. And substitute the words 4 cents. Ms. Eubanks, did you second that?
Second. I have now.
any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. The motion carries 3-0. And any other suggestions to the staff draft? Mr. Murray?
Yeah, and this is just, I'm just wondering if the consistency's sake, then you want $100 to $100 written out. I don't know. I just offer that up.
You know, it struck me. I mean, I wondered about that, but I somehow $100 is just easy to read, at least. I'm okay with it, but I don't feel strongly about it. It's something about the $.04 that bothered me. It's just hard to read. But I didn't want people to think that was $4 or something else. But I don't know. Any other suggested changes to the staff draft?
I thought it was better the other way, but there, any of these is fine. Changing that, leaving it, leaving both is fine with me.
Is there a motion to adopt the staff draft, Ms. Eubanks?
I would move that we adopt the staff draft as amended for proposed initiative 103.
I'll second that. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0, and that concludes action on number 103. The time is 1:26 p.m.
Well, my brain's not working fast enough to figure out what I was supposed to be about. So I guess Jeff's supposed to do this one. He did that.
I told him.
Well, I'm not supposed to come back. Towards the end. I mean, I can try to do the rehearing, or...
We're just going to...
However you want to do it. Okay, I'm going to go pack then.
Let's move on to the next agenda item, which is 2007-2008 number 92, employer responsibility for health insurance. This is here on a motion for rehearing. Jeff Blue from the AG's office is actually, he heard the original, was here for the original hearing, and I told him we would not be getting to this item this quick, but I think he'll be presumably joining us shortly. He just, I misled him about the timing of this, but he may be here shortly. But let's go ahead and get started even in his absence. I don't know whether his vote will be necessary or not, but I just don't want to hold up things. So, Mr. Friednesh, this is your motion for rehearing. If you'd like to tell us what you need to tell us.
Sure.
Sure. Good afternoon. Doug Friedenash for the record. I'm going to make my comments relatively short again because I presume you've read the motion for rehearing and are pretty familiar with this initiative. Briefly, the purpose of this initiative is to basically create a mandate on employers to provide health care coverage. And the way it does that is it says to employers that you can do it either directly or indirectly, directly through your health care carrier, or indirectly through a newly created health insurance authority, and you have to provide, employees are not required to provide more than 20% of the cost of health care for themselves, and up to 30% for their dependents. And as I said, how it works is the employer, if they have a, if they're already providing insurance or able to provide insurance, they can do that through their carrier or organization, whatever health insurance organization they utilize. They can also do it indirectly. And they do this by this new insurance authority creating coverage through carriers, companies, and organizations that they can provide coverage to, provide, enter into contracts with. Although, oddly, they can't provide health insurance, but the employees are paying the premium to this authority. So the authority, ultimately, the health insurance authority has two purposes, to provide the indirect coverage and then to administer the program. Clearly, there is a relationship between the authority providing this indirect coverage or access to it, but we think the expansion of this new constitutionally regulatory authority, which creates a massive bureaucracy, is a much different subject. That is, that by going beyond just providing these contracts with, so employees can go ahead and negotiate directly with these companies, that they go far beyond that. And the administration portion of this is a separate subject. And in the following ways, I mean, I think the authority will, you know, obviously they're going to have to monitor and research insurance. They're going to have to look for the cheapest and most comprehensive insurance plans. They have the power to contract with, but they don't, and collect premiums, but they don't have the power to provide health insurance. They're going to have to enter into all kinds of regulations. There's going to be communications. They may be involved in processing claims. They will be responsible for the operation of the plan, which will include such things as requests by employers or employees for coverage when there is no coverage. And they're going to be required to review plans and reporting requirements and forthwith. The whole mechanism of health insurance is a very complicated beast. And in a way, it's really a Trojan horse for a single-payer system, in a way. It's just a bifurcated mechanism to do that. The other basic fundamental problem with this is that while this is being sold as having employers provide health insurance, ultimately, and I think this was the problem that Mr. Blue pointed out last week, is ultimately what it really is doing is it provides government-subsidized health insurance, because if there's not enough money from the employers to cover the administration costs of this program or to provide for the health insurance premiums, the state can find what other sources of revenue that they can find exclusive of general fund costs to administer the program. And they basically would be able to, the state would be required to figure out how to pay for health insurance costs for employees, not just the health insurance costs for the employers, which is clearly falls within the scope of this, but also employees. If employees don't have health care coverage, the state is going to have to step in and provide funding for that. If employees can't pay their share, they have to provide coverage for that. If the family members of those employees can't provide coverage, they have to provide coverage for that. And if there's not enough money to administer the program, this new bureaucracy has to pay for that or find the means to pay for that. Since it can't be general funds, I assume we're talking about fees or, you know, borrowing from trust funds. I don't know. But those are, I think that's a separate and distinct subject than just employers providing health insurance. And I think while it's covered here, that I think it is misleading to say that the employers can provide health insurance. There is no penalty mechanism. obviously, I guess the General Assembly can do that. They have authority to define terms and enforce this, but there is no mechanism in and of itself. So I think, again, in summary, the three purposes are, you know, they're providing health insurance, but we're creating this new authority that goes way beyond just facilitating or implementing that. They're going to administer a program, and then it's really a state-subsidized program, not just an employer-provided program that ultimately provides insurance and administers the program. With that, happy to take any questions.
Okay. And I'll note that Mr. Blue has joined us, and I apologize again for misleading Mr. Blue into thinking we would not get to this one that quickly. But as you noted, I think he had some concerns last time, so I want to give him a chance to get up to speed. And let me just ask Mr. Friednesch just a couple of things. The title set by the board expressed the single subject as health care coverage for employees, which seems to be broad enough to cover everything that you've discussed. But I guess you would disagree with that characterization of the single subject.
Well, let me start. I think you got to go a little beyond that. But yes, I mean, I think, you know, the purpose of this was to require employers to provide health insurance coverage. That's the stated purpose. I understood that is the purpose that I heard last week. And then I may be mistaken, but that's my recollection. But it's not just about employers providing health insurance. This is a government-subsidized program. And ultimately, the taxpayers are going to be ultimately, somebody's going to be responsible for paying for the enormous costs of this program. If the insurance is unaffordable, somebody's going to have to pick up the tab, and I don't know who that's going to be, but it's misleading to say that the next sentence requires employers that regularly employ 20 more employees to provide health care coverage. I think it should say right up front, requiring employers or the state to provide insurance, because that's really what this does.
Other questions for Mr. Friednesch? Thank you. Mr. Bellow, if you'd like to respond on behalf of proponents.
Thank you, members of the board. Michael Bellow of Barenbaum, Weinschenk & Eason on behalf of the proponents. First, I'd like to address right up front one of the questions that Mr. Friednesch just raised about the sources of funding. I mean, it's quite clear from the language of this initiative that the primary source of funding is expected to be employer premiums paid to the insurance authority. And it's also quite clear that if necessary, as a backstop, although the state legislature could not use general funds, it could seek other sources of revenue. So there's nothing hidden about the funding mechanism. The fact that there may be a primary funding mechanism and a fallback or secondary funding mechanism doesn't make it a violation of the single subject rule. They're both stated in there, and there have been many initiatives which have dealt with how you fund something, and we've just set forth how we would anticipate that this would be funded. So the method of funding doesn't make it a violation of single subject. It seems to me that there are really sort of there's a single subject issue here, but then there's a group of complaints about the title that we can address in a minute. But I would say that in reference to the single subject issue, we think that rather than showing that there's a genuine issue about a single subject, what the opponents have done here is they've parsed the initiative into its separate provisions and thereby try to convert those closely related and interdependent provisions into separate subjects. They supposedly derived five different subjects out of this simply by taking the provisions of the initiative. And we think it's to the contrary. It's clear that the purpose of this initiative is to require every employer with 20 or more employees to provide major medical health care coverage. Every other provision relates directly to implementation. Either they provide it directly or they provide it indirectly through the health insurance authority by paying premiums. The authority itself is not a separate subject. There have been other comparable amendments that have created some form of commission or authority. For example, the limited gambling amendment that created a commission, a limited gaming commission, in order to administer the gambling initiative. We've done essentially the same thing here to create an authority that would be, the exact parameters of it would be defined by the legislature, but that legislature, that authority would administer the provisions of the initiative, and that in itself doesn't create a single subject issue. That is merely a mechanism for implementing the single purpose of
Mr.
requiring
Bell,
health insurance.
Can I take you back a bit?
Yes.
To the issue of government funding of this? Is the way I read the initiative is that there's no requirement that the authority set premiums at a level that would fund itself and fund the insurance it provides to employers. And the title of the initiative is not employees are receiving health care coverage, but employers to provide health care coverage. So without a requirement that the employers pay high enough premiums to the authority to cover the health care coverage, it seems to me that this isn't necessarily employers to provide health care coverage. It's a state mandate on health care coverage being provided to employees that can be covered by the state.
Well, if you look at Section 4, subsection 4 of the amendment, the final sentence says, in the alternative, other than directly providing it by offering a health insurance plan, in the alternative, an employer shall provide health care coverage indirectly by paying premiums to the authority in such amounts as are determined by the authority to fulfill the requirements of this section. Now, that may not expressly state what you've just asked me, should it expressly state, but clearly implicit in that is that the authority has the power and is directed to set premiums in such amount as to fulfill the requirements, which would include the requiring the that the major medical health care coverage comply with the percentage requirements for employee contribution and employer contribution.
Then isn't the initiative itself internally contradictory? To have a section that says that the state can pay for it, but at the same time that the, reading your interpretation, that the authority has to set premiums that will cover the cost of the initiative.
No, I don't think it's internally contradictory. As we state in the initiative, it simply states that the General Assembly shall not be precluded from using other sources of revenue if necessary. I mean, it's quite clear that is very much of a fallback position, that the primary mechanism for funding this authority, as clearly stated in the and for providing the health care coverage indirectly, is the premiums that are to be set by the authority. And so I don't believe that is contradictory to state as essentially as a fallback or a position if necessary, that the state can find sources other than the general fund if necessary. So I would disagree that it's internally contradictory, and we think it's a method of stating the funding sources. And the primary funding source is the premium set by the authority and to fulfill the requirements of the section. And we believe that the implementation provisions are very straightforward, very capable of being readily understood by the voters. Refer you to Article 18, Section 14. That's the Medical Marijuana Initiative. That sets forth a very complex, about a three-page scheme, but it's closely connected framework for implementation of the central purpose. And what we've done here is to set forth a concise and I think easily understandable scheme for administering the requirement of health care coverage and for paying for it. I wanted to refer to the water rights case the opponents cited in their motion. It is Water Rights 2, I think they cited it. And in that case, it was clear from the decision. It's clear on the face of the motion that there were two unconnected purposes. One, water district must hold elections to change their boundaries or discontinue their existence. Two, there must be dedication of water right use to the public. And those are two clearly unconnected purposes. That's really not apropos to this particular situation here. As the court said, that the public trust water rights paragraphs of the initiative impose obligations on the state of Colorado to recognize and protect public ownership of water. Water conservancy or conservation districts have little or no power over the administration of the public water rights. So it was quite clear that was, and it is not comparable to the situation here where we do have a single purpose and a method of implementing that purpose. I'd like to comment on, aside from the single purpose, if there are any other questions you have about the single purpose, I'd like to comment on two other points. One of them is the catchphrase issue that they've raised. And I, you know, for the life of me, I'm having a hard time thinking of major medical health care coverage as a catchphrase. That wouldn't even fit on a bumper, unless maybe it's a Hummer or something like that. But it's, you know, major medical is a descriptive term, limiting descriptive term, and health care coverage. That's, there's no sloganeering involved in that. In looking at catchphrases, the court has said that the rule recognizes that the particular words chosen by the title board should not prejudice electors to vote for or against the proposed initiative merely by virtue of those words appeal to emotion. And I think any reasonable person viewing the title set by the board would conclude that health care coverage and major medical health care coverage, those are descriptive terms. Catchphrases are words that work to a proposal's favor without contributing to voter understanding. They form the basis of a slogan for those who expect to carry out a campaign for or against and initiate a constitutional amendment, thus further prejudicing voter understanding of the issues actually presented. There's nothing prejudicial about the term major medical health care coverage or health care coverage. Those are, I'm trying to think of words that would be any better, descriptive words that would be any better to express the purpose of the initiative. Then finally, on the title issues, we should keep in mind, I think as Mr. Blue pointed out a little bit earlier today, that under CRS 140.102.10, the title should be, quote, a brief statement that fairly and accurately captures the true meaning and intent of the proposed text, that the board's duty, quote, and from the decision here, is to capture in short form the proposal in plain, understandable, accurate language. That the board has done here. The board is not obligated to reiterate every provision of the initiative. And I'll go through just a couple of these questions about the title, and if you have any questions about any of the other complaints about the title, then I can address that. But for example, on page 6, subsection 2, they say that the title fails to mention that the effective date of the initiative is delayed until the General Assembly has an opportunity to enact appropriate legislation. We don't believe that is a material omission from the title. It clearly does say the effective date of the measure to be no later than November 1, 2009. It clearly says directing the General Assembly to enact such laws as are necessary to implement the measure. That's similarly 3, not a material omission. The title fails to mention that major medical coverage is not defined by the initiative. The title again, referring to the enact such laws as are necessary to implement the initiative, it's not a crucial
Mr. Bell,
requirement.
On that one, wouldn't it be pretty simple to say after major medical health care coverage, comma, to be defined by the General Assembly, end comma?
I don't have any problem with that.
I mean, wouldn't that solve that problem pretty simply?
I wouldn't have any problem with that. I mean, one thing that you balance, I'm sure the title board tries to balance the fact that these become so verbose or so laden with phrases that they become more difficult for people to understand. But on the other hand, you balance that with putting important provisions. We don't have any problem with that kind of an addition to it if the board deems it necessary. And a couple other ones, 5 and 6, the title doesn't disclose the scope of the authority must be created and defined by the General Assembly. We don't believe that's a material omission from the title. 6 is not accurate. The title does not disclose the General Assembly is required to find the source of revenue to pay for health care coverage. The title, in fact, does say in near the conclusion of the first paragraph of the paragraph that financing the cost of administering the health insurance authority and health care coverage. In fact, we've worked through this at some length in the previous title board hearing. In summary, we don't believe that the alleged omissions from the title are material omissions or that they accurately state the title and that they're, in some respects, it's not really an accurate statement of the title here in the objection. So if there are any questions about any other provisions of the title, I'm willing to address those. But in summary, we believe that it's a single subject. Again, it's a concise method of implementing the single subject. The fact that there's a potential fallback source of funding doesn't detract from the central purpose of the initiative, that the employer shall provide it and that it be funded by premiums charged to employers by the authority. And we believe the title board was correct when they initially set the title, and we urge you to reject the motion for rehearing.
Any further questions for Mr. Bellow? If not, Mr. Friedenash, brief response?
Brief. Okay, brevity, and I will be brief. Just a couple basic comments. First of all, this is much different than the gaming authority. I mean, the gaming authority is not running gambling establishments. This is different. The state is involved in the contracting and collecting premiums and finding insurance and dealing with a lot more. So they really are the gambling establishment here. And significantly, I didn't hear a lot about the bureaucracy this is creating, but there is a major difference between an authority that helps provide indirect coverage and an authority that's fully engaged in administering that bureaucracy. And I think that's a substantial difference. Finally, to Mr. Blue's question, the authority doesn't just deal with employers and what happens with employers who can't meet their obligations. This initiative deals with employees and what happens when employees can't meet their 20% or 30% for their families. Who do they come to? Well, they would have to make claims to the insurance authority, and then employers are ultimately going to pay more than their fair share into this 80-20 or 70-30 split, because somebody's going to have to pick up the cost. And I would suggest that that's going to happen through fees or through borrowing from trust funds or something. I mean, maybe a hidden tax.
I'm confused. I don't see in the initiative anywhere that says that if an employee can't afford to pay their 20%, the employer has to pick it up or the state has to pick it up.
Well, here's how I read it.
And so help me.
It says in section 3, and here it's just, I think, the interpretation of this, which you're entitled to interpret this. But subsection 3 says the very last sentence, well, let me go up above that. Subsection 3 says the General Assembly shall not be precluded from using other sources of revenue if necessary to pay for the cost administering the authority or providing the health care coverage mandated by the section. Part of the insurance coverage that this deals with is the fact that employers can't force employees to pay more than a certain share. So I think by the terms of this, employees have the right to request assistance with their health insurance portion of this. I think that falls within the purview of what this initiative states. That's all I have, unless there's anything else.
Any other questions for Mr. Friedenash? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Then I'll turn to board discussion on the motion for rehearing.
I'm still of the opinion that this is two subjects. I think it opens toward a public financing of health care coverage. I'm not so sure I agree with Mr. Friedenash's characterization of paying the employer's portion of it, but I still think that it allows – it's either internally contradictory, if you read it how Mr. Bellow suggested today, or it's two subjects, and so I think it's violative of the two-subject rule.
I think I'm probably still okay with the measure as complying with single subject and okay with the title set by the board before. I know there's frequently questions of interpretation and drafting, but it still seems to me that this is a single subject that relates to health care coverage for employees, and so I would support denying the motion for rehearing. But so Ms. Eubanks, I guess it's up to you.
I think I am where I was at 2 weeks ago. I'm not persuaded by any of the arguments made in the motion for rehearing. I believe the measure contains a single subject, that subject being stated in the title that we set concerning health care coverage for employees. I agree with you, Mr. Hobbs, in terms of, you know, there's a lot of hypothetical interpretations that could occur under the language of the measure. I don't think that that's for us to determine. I don't see a funding requirement in the measure. It just talks about if the General Assembly finds that it's necessary, that it cannot use certain funds and it can use sources, other sources of revenue. I don't see that requiring funding for the indirect health care coverage mandated by the measure or for the employee portion on the direct coverage. So I'm fine on single subject grounds. I'm also fine with the title as we set it.
I think I'll go ahead and offer a motion that the...
We'll deal with the title second, right?
Well, I actually was going to move to deny the motion for rehearing, but if you want to discuss issues...
I agree that we probably should put something in there that says that the definition of major medical health care is going to be... that the General Assembly is going to define that for us. Because I think that different people have different ideas of what that means. It's not clear. It's not defined in the measure. And so I think it is important to add a brief clause that says to be defined by the General Assembly.
Well, I guess the reason why I didn't feel it was necessary is that unless I'm missing something, I mean, I think the concept is pretty clear. The details of exactly what is major medical, maybe it does need to be defined. But we've already said in the titles, I think towards the end, we're directing the General Assembly, this is line 14, to enact such laws as are necessary to implement the measure. And that could be definitions or other things, I guess, other administrative details. I'm not sure about why we need to focus on that particular definition. I mean, I know that's central to the measure.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's the central subject of this, is major, sorry, I always forget, major health care coverage. And I think it's important that people understand that the General Assembly is going to be coming up with that definition, and that could change on a regular basis, frankly, as they start adding coverages or what have you to it, or deleting coverages from it. So, I mean, I think that it's important that be clear that's going to be defined by the General Assembly. So let's talk about process for a second here. Can I ask that we separate these somehow and deal with them separately? Because I'm going to – my votes obviously are split on these two issues.
If you – I mean, I guess you process-wise, I think you could move
– now?
I think, yes, now that we amend the titles. And I'm just trying to think through the next step would be, and if there's no other motions, then a motion could be either to deny the motion for rehearing except to the extent the board has amended the titles, and that would incorporate, if your motion is successful, to change the titles, or a motion to simply deny title setting, although it sounds like that probably won't be made. But so in other words, I think process-wise, we can get to it. We can amend the titles and then incorporate that in a motion to otherwise deny the motion for rehearing. Does that make sense?
Then why don't I do this? Why don't I make a motion that on line 3 after coverage to insert a comma as defined by the General Assembly, comma. Or actually, sorry, to be defined by the General Assembly.
And can I ask one question? Just want to make sure. Is there anything in the measure that says that? Does it, maybe I missed something, does it require the General
Assembly? Hobbs at the the bottom of subsection 6, shall annex such, the General Assembly shall annex such laws as are necessary, and then in the second phrase, to define terms that are not defined in this section, including the required components of health care coverage. But that's the reference.
Okay. It doesn't actually require a definition of major medical health care coverage.
No, but that's the
But it does require the General Assembly to enact legislation,
right,
and so forth.
Okay,
thank you for pointing that
out. If I could, just one comment in regard to where you would like to place that, is it sounds to me that that breaks up the phrase rather badly.
There's two employees, then
so you have this phrase in the middle of it, which I think could be sort of confusing to people to have that phrase before you get to their employees. I would suggest, I don't have any real objection to Mr. Blue's suggestions, as I originally mentioned to him, but I do think that we should try to find a better place for it that would break up an important clause.
Do you have a suggestion?
I'm open to suggestions on it. And if you want to change it to say that the required components of health care coverage are going to be defined by the or set by the General Assembly, we could change it to that if that's what you want.
I think it might be appropriate down here to directing the General Assembly to enact such laws as are necessary. Perhaps put something in enact such laws,
including
define such terms, including components of health care coverage.
Sure. That's fine by me.
Required components.
So why don't we modify my motion, all right, amend the motion, to implement the measure, comma, and then, Mr. Bellow, would you suggest we go including to define terms that are not defined in this section, including the required components of health care coverage?
Perhaps to define terms such as the required components of health care coverage.
Sure, that's fine.
After measure on line 15. No, the other measure, sorry. The first one. I didn't realize there were two. I think that's a semicolon, right? So comma.
So what were you going to suggest?
As I said, implement the measure, define terms such as required components of health care coverage. That's the phrase in the initiative. Such as the required components of health care coverage.
Have a semicolon there. Components. Required components of health care coverage.
I think that's fairly concise.
So that's my motion.
I don't feel strongly about it. I mean, I'm not crazy about including that clause at all, that this is a major feature, that the General Assembly is required to enact laws as are necessary to implement the requirement. But we do have it. And if we want to expand upon that, I think that's an accurate statement, as Mr. Blue has amended the titles. But I don't think I'll second the motion. But I don't have any strong objections about it. Is there a second, Ms. Eubanks?
I will second it only because Mr. Bellow's agreeable to the change. I think it's already included in the phrase directing the General Assembly to enact such laws as are necessary to implement the measure. But if you think that improves...
If I could, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to...
No, that's fine.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessary. I just say that if it were added because the board required it to be added, it wouldn't be a big problem for us. But I don't think it's necessary either. I think that it's enacting such laws as are necessary covers it. Just saying, I wouldn't object strongly if it were added, but I don't think it's necessary.
Not going to second the motion.
Okay, then that motion dies for lack of a second. Are there other changes to the titles as set by the board? If not, is there a motion? Ms. Eubanks?
I move that we deny the motion for rehearing.
I'll second that. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye. Aye. All those opposed, no.
No.
That motion carries 2-1. That completes action on number 92. The time is 2:03 p.m. Let's go to the next agenda item, item number 14, which is 2007-2008, number 95, taxable values and taxes of property. This is before the board on a motion for rehearing. Mr. Dunn, I think this is your motion, so I'll turn it over to you, please.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Jason Dunn with Brownstein, Hyatt, Farber, Schreck, on behalf of the petitioners. As an initial matter, we are dropping our petition for rehearing on the issue related to the fiscal note, our fiscal analysis provided by OSPB. I'll speak only to the title. You may want to wait until that's up there. Let me, before we actually get to the actual text, step back for a minute. Talk about Gallagher. I was always reticent to talk about Tabor and Gallagher and those kinds of things when I was on the board with Ms. Eubanks around. I'm probably even more so when I'm up here. But the Gallagher Amendment does two things. One is that it requires, it currently requires, valuation for assessment on non-residential property be at 29%. The other impact is that the non-residential and residential ratio we set at 55% to 45%, as you all know. What this measure does in increasing the non-residential assessment for evaluation for assessment, well, let me step back again. Currently, you may all already know this, under Gallagher, then to maintain the 55-45 ratio, residential property tax rates have dropped. Because Tabor was enacted after Gallagher, that rate was not allowed to increase to maintain the 55-45 ratio. So what's happened is actually the residential right now is 7.9-something when it actually should be 8-point-something to maintain the 55-45. So we actually have greater disparity than that 10% currently. With this change that's proposed in Initiative 95, that number will be exacerbated further because we cannot allow the residential rate to be increased without a vote. The net effect of that is that in the future, should either commercial valuations go down or residential rate valuations go up, such that the residential assessment rate would drop, the net effect of this is to delay that from happening. In other words, to steal a discussion from earlier in the last year in the legislative session, this freezes residential property tax rates from dropping as they would otherwise in the future. And therefore, with regard to the title, and I understand the language that it's amending is to the non-residential portion of Gallagher, but I think with regard to the title, and particularly the statement of single subject, the reference to non-residential property is inaccurate. And I think that at a minimum, it's completely inaccurate, and at best, we just don't know how it's going to affect residential property rates and taxation. So I think that it's misleading to the voters to imply that this won't impact their residential property tax assessments. I have a second issue, which kind of is further down in the title, but if you have questions on that, we can talk about that, and I can move on.
But do you have a suggestion on how to change that part of the title?
Well, I would strike non-residential. Actually, I would strike on non-residential property.
The reason you say that needs to happen is that because residential rates will not decrease as quickly after this passes as they would otherwise?
That's correct.
Okay, I'm being slow here. So the actual suggested change to the title for that part of it, local taxes shall be increased by $577.3 million annually in the state one area. Then you just pick up by an amendment to the code.
That's right, or you could reference property. Tax on property probably requires tweaking, but the idea is to strike the indication in the single subject clause that it's only affects non-residential property.
Okay. Then your other issue? Next issue?
The other issue is with regard to reference. I know this is taken sort of literally from the measure and the reference to the increase from 29 to 34%. But I think the average voter, in fact, I think the vast majority of voters actually have no idea how their property taxes are calculated. And to talk about an increase from 29 to 34 in the valuation for assessment, what that means, I think the vast majority of people have no idea what that means. And I think what they will see this as is, oh, my taxes are going to go up 5%. That's what this means. But what this really means is that taxes will go up 17.24%, because it's a 5% increase only on 29% of the value of the property. If you apply that to the 100% of the valuation, that's actually 17.24%. So rather than talk about 29 to 34 on the valuation for assessment of taxable property other than non-residential, it seems to be more clear, more accurate, and more informative to the average voter to say that that this is a 17% tax increase. And I think even in that portion, or 17.24, and I think in that portion, I think it's more appropriate perhaps to refer to non-residential, because that's what Gallagher refers to, and it's more literal in that portion of the title. But I think the average voter would want to know, what's this do to my bottom line? And the bottom line is it's a 17.24% property tax increase.
Sorry, Jason, but I'm low on this. Can you explain to me why that's 17% again, and it's opposed to the 5%?
Sure. The way your property taxes are calculated is they take, right now, 29% of the assessed value of your house. If you live in a $1 million house, times that by 29%, then you times that by the mill levy, and that gives you your property taxes. So what you're really only doing is looking at 29% of the value of your house to figure your property taxes. You're not looking at 100% of the value. So what this does is increases that portion by 5%. But when you're looking at what it actually does to your taxes, it's a 17% increase in your property tax bill. That's the net effect of it, because 5% on top of 29% is a 17% increase. That's what the voters will really care about, because that's how it affects their wallet.
Wouldn't it be more appropriate to address that in the Blue Book? I mean, isn't this part of explaining what the measure does? It may even be part of the arguments for or against, but certainly in explaining the impact of a measure.
Well, I think the purpose of the title is to explain what the measure does, not the technical mechanism for how it goes about doing that. There was a reference earlier to the the medical marijuana initiative, which I couldn't recite to you now, but I think that 3 pages. Well, obviously you're not going to stick all that in the title. The idea of the title is to explain in a way that the common average voter can understand what it does for them, and how, and educate them on how to vote, is to explain the bottom line of what it does. And we don't need to go through the machinations of using verbatim language or technical language that would just confuse voters, but rather to just explain bottom line is, to explain it in a way that they can understand.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Dunn? Okay. Thank you.
Well, one point I was actually listening earlier, and I think, Mr. Blue, you made this point. Can't remember which one it was, but I think it was the last measure up before the lunch break, talking about the need to explain things, not quoting directly the measure, but in a way that the voters can understand. I was actually listening in, and I thought that was a really good point. I think that's applicable here as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bellow, if you'd like to respond on behalf of proponents, please.
I don't purport to be an expert in property tax, and probably Mr. Dunn is more of an expert at it than I am, but I would like to point out that when he's talking about your property being assessed at 29% or 34% of the value, he's talking about non-residential property. Residential property now is assessed at, I think, 7.96% of actual value. So this is not an increase on residential property. This is an increase on the rate, the assessment rate on non-residential property or other than.
And Mr. Dunn said that it would probably be more accurate to put non-residential property in here. What he's talking, though, about, though, is the fact that by going from 29 to 34%,
I understand that point.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I'd like to hear you respond to that because that's compelling to me, and so I'm curious to your response.
I think the problem with that is that then, if that were the case, then the central element of this initiative, which is the one sentence in the middle of the initiative, I mean, in the middle of the Gallagher Amendment, that is that makes the change from 29% to 34% on property other than residential real property, would be neglected. It would be disregarded. I mean, that is the central point. That's the major change. The rest of this is just implementation issues. That would be not subject to the spending limitations or the revenue limitations. But that's, I'm concerned that there would be no reference to the central point of it. I think I agree that property tax is a complex issue, but in the first place, it wouldn't be accurate to say that a person's property tax on residential property would be increased by 17%. So I'm concerned about something that would essentially delete the central phrase, the central change, and really the only change that this does to the Gallagher Amendment from the description of the title.
Mr. Bell, though, isn't it accurate to say that it is a tax increase of 17% on non-residential property?
It would
assuming the math is right. I
think the math is approximately right, but I agree with Mr. Hobbs that that's something that's appropriate to talk about in a campaign. That's something that's appropriate to perhaps deal with in the Blue Book. But in terms of faithfully reflecting the amendment here or the initiative, we believe that phrase is essential to it. I would also point out that we do think it's important to keep the phrase non-residential property in line two. And we had a discussion about this, and again, I don't purport to be an expert. I think it's generally true from my discussions with the Division of Property Taxation in drafting this measure that it would end up freezing the residential rate for a longer period of time than it would otherwise be frozen. That doesn't mean it's going to be an increase in taxes on residential property. But I do think the property tax experts are all somewhat a little bit mystified by the exact mechanism of Gallagher as it feeds through Tabor and the other statutes. But this is not a property tax increase on residential property. It's a property tax increase on non-residential property.
But property taxes are, in Colorado, they're assessed in conjunction with one another, residential, non-residential. And so in essence, to get this increase, to get this $577 million increase, you have to freeze the residential property rates for a period of time, or else residential property rates have to decline under Gallagher as it currently stands. Right? I mean, am I not accurate about that?
My understanding, and again, I'm going based upon my subject matter experts here that I've consulted with in the Division of Property Taxation in drafting this, that this there'd be no increase in the residential tax rate as a result of this, that this might result in it taking longer for the residential rate to currently the calculated residential rate is something like 8.5%, but because of Tabor, it's at 7.96% because they could not raise it. My understanding is that this would just make that period, it would be a longer period of time than it would otherwise be without this amendment where the residential rate would be frozen. We don't see that as any kind of a significant impact upon residential property rates that justifies deleting the language on non-residential.
What would be a
property.
Significant impact on residential rates then?
I couldn't speculate. I don't know. This one doesn't. This is not intended to, and we don't believe it has a reasonably foreseeable effect upon residential property tax rates. I guess the best I can say about it at this point, it's not reasonably foreseeable. So, our view is that the descriptive phrase on non-residential property is accurate and necessary to ensure that voters are not misled or confused, because looking at this without that phrase, voters are more likely to think that, oh, this is an increase on my residential property tax rates of $577 million, and that is totally contrary to the intent and purpose of this measure. So that's why we believe it's actually more descriptive more accurate to have that phrase in, that modifier in there, and it's consistent with the language in Gallagher, in Tabor, which just starts off with the expression, shall blank district taxes or whatever be increased annually, then dot, dot, dot. And that's the prescribed language. It doesn't say that you can't add something after that prescribed language. And the title as set by the board has that language in the title as well as in the submission clause. But it doesn't prohibit the board from having a modifier that, in our view, makes it clearer and less likely to mislead than the absence of that provision would.
Thank you. Mr. Dunn, any brief remarks in response?
Only briefly. I think I did misspeak in my example. I gave it referring to your home. I should have referred to your warehouse or something like that, but tax being on the commercial side. But I do think it's important that voters understand the impact on residential property valuations. Just a trial that took a week or last, I believe, on the whole issue of whether freezing property taxes, freezing a mill levy, tax increase. I think it does, and it's built in their pocketbook, and it's a result of a tax policy change. It sounds like a tax, but I think the issue here is whether or not that's a major function of the measure, whether or not it's intended or not, it's a major impact. And when you have a tax policy change that's going to freeze property taxes for residential homeowners and not allow them to drop, I think voters need to be educated about that so they can vote appropriately.
Mr. Dunn, doesn't this title get to that with lines 5 through 7? By saying it's exempted from all other limitations?
That language refers to the Tabor debrucing of the measure for purposes of keeping excess revenue. I don't think that in any way references the result on residential property tax assessment rates, which would keep them from dropping from their current, I think, 7.96 to going down even further if they should in the future. But I think that's just a reference to revenue.
Thank you. I don't have anybody else signed up to testify, but is there anybody else who wishes to testify on the motion for rehearing? Seeing none, I'll just turn to board discussion then. Ms. Eubanks?
This is, dealing with property taxes, an extremely difficult subject matter, both, I think, for us in devising a title as well as for the voters in understanding a measure. There's lots of variables here. Some of them are indicated in the fiscal analysis provided by OSPB in trying to give us a fiscal estimate for the title. Whether or not this, assuming everything else remains the same, that the residential rate stays at its current level for longer than it otherwise would, maybe so. You have the variables of what happens to the housing market and the values in general, where they go. I mean, there's the values of commercial property other than what's involved with coming up with their valuation for assessment. It's very hard to, at least in my mind, to say that this is going to happen or this is going to happen or this is going to happen as a result of this measure. And I don't think we should be going there because it's just, there's a lot of theory. There's a lot of variables. I don't think we have enough information to be able to include and should include in the title in terms of what's going to happen to the residential ratio. This measure before us, the text of the measure, does not change anything in terms of coming up with that mechanism of Gallagher of keeping the ratio between residential and non-residential property. It doesn't change that. The only thing that it changes is the percentage that commercial property is going to be valued at for property tax purposes. I think that's what we have to limit the title to. I don't think that to do anything more, I don't believe would be a correct representation of what the measure in terms of the text does. Now, I agree with Mr. Hobbs that perhaps some of these possibilities are more appropriate to be discussed in a blue book if this measure were to make the ballot. But I'm terribly uncomfortable theorizing on what increasing the percentage for commercial property, increasing it up to 34%, is going to do. I think that the title should state what this measure does, which is change the percentage of actual value that is used for taxing non-residential property. I don't think that we have anything to base saying it in terms other than valuation for assessment at 34% of actual value, because that's what the measure does. Again, to convert it into something else, I don't think that's the proper role of this board to do. I think the title is accurate in terms of the statement that it's the increase of the $577.3 million is based on the change in the rate for the non-residential property. That's an accurate statement. I'm not comfortable changing that to residential property because, one, I don't think that the figure presented to us by OSPB took anything into consideration for that. I don't think that would be an accurate number. And again, I think that's going off in terms of hypotheticals of what the dollar amount, if there'd be any change to taxes for residential property. Because the residential ratio stays the same for a longer amount of time, which we don't even know will actually happen. You don't know what mill levies are going to be doing, what they're going to be set at. I don't think we can go there because I don't think we have that information. I think it's all theory, hypotheticals, and I think the best we can do is have the title that we have that pretty much sets out what the measure does, and that's affecting the percentage of actual value that's used for property tax purposes for non-residential property.
Mr. Hobbs, if I may.
Mr. Dunn.
And I probably wasn't clear. What we're not requesting is that it reference that tax as a tax on residential property. I agree with everything you said in the first half of your statement, that we don't know what's going to happen. And that's why I think we can't just refer to the impact only on non-residential. My preference is to take out any reference to whether it's residential or non-residential because we don't know the impact. I'm not suggesting that we should say it's a half-billion-dollar increase on residential property.
Well,
we're saying we should
my problem is that by removing the reference to non-residential, then at least there's an inference that it is for all property that's subject to property tax, not just non-residential. I mean, by removing that limiting language, to me, you've broadened out that category to include all property, residential and non-residential. And that's why I don't believe that that would be an accurate statement.
Well, that's why I was suggesting, I think earlier, that in the single subject statement, you could remove the reference to either residential or non-residential, because that's more a statement of the purpose of the measure. But in this second part of the title, you could maintain, I guess, if you didn't want to go with the suggestion I had about 17% increase, maintain the language that you have with regard to the non-residential, because that's actually a discussion of what the measure actually says, as opposed to the single subject clause, which talks about the impact of the measure.
And I think we may just differ in terms of that, the language there on line two. I'm not comfortable taking out non-residential because I think that's misleading to say that, because that at least gives an inference that taxes are going up on all property subject to property tax and not just the non-residential.
Well, why the number wouldn't be probably accurate in that case. I think the statement actually is correct, that property taxes across the board could go up, or at least be frozen, depending on what you define as a tax freeze.
And I'm just terribly uncomfortable because there's so many variables. I don't know if that's a correct statement. I think that based on this language change, assuming everything else remains the same, I'm comfortable with that statement for non-residential. Other than that, I don't know. And based on the change of this measure itself in terms of the language that it changes in Section 3 of Article 10, all it does is it's changing the assessment, valuation for assessment for non-residential property, and that's why I think the title needs to be drafted the way it is.
And I think I agree with Ms. Eubanks. I think it's better for the board to focus on what the measure does and rather than what the measure might end up doing when we take into consideration the effects. But I'd be inclined to stick with what the board has done at this point.
I'm sympathetic to the arguments made by Mr. Don, but at the end of the day, I think that clear enunciation of what the measure does, technically, I think that there is a concern that people don't understand, that the public is going to have trouble understanding this is not a 5% increase, this is a 17% increase. That the $577 million increase does have, property tax in Colorado is combined. It's kind of hard not to look at them both together. And so I'm sympathetic, but I think at the end of the day, this serves its purpose, and those arguments can be made in the Blue Book and, frankly, in any campaign that's
If there's no other discussion, is there a motion? Ms. Eubanks?
I would move that we deny the motion for rehearing on Initiative 95.
Second that. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That completes action on number 95. The time is 2:30 p.m. Go on to agenda item number 15, which is
16, probably.
What's that?
We're probably going to do both right here.
It could be, and really, which is also related to number 16. Number 15 is number 91A, state sales tax for services for individuals with developmental disabilities. Mr. Stedman, perhaps if you'd like to explain how this relates to the previous 91 and also give us, is it any different than 128, which is our next agenda item, et cetera? Just get us all on the same page, if you would.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. My name is Pat Stedman. I'm representing the proponents of these two measures, 91A and 128. To your questions, Mr. Chairman, number 91A represents is virtually identical to Proposal 91 that you saw 2 weeks ago. However, the proponents did make one change that was responsive to an issue raised in review and comment, and that had to do with a sunset date that was put on the state use tax. That is no longer part of this proposal, and so the existing use tax continues, and then the increment of increase proposed by the measure would be added to that. The next item on your agenda, proposed initiative number 128, is identical to 91.
Okay.
Are you going to withdraw one of them?
Actually, we were planning on seeing if we could have both of them set for title today. Obviously, only one will go forward. They're identical. But given that they both came here through different procedures to get to this point today, we thought we'd go forward with both of them and see what happens on rehearing. If you'd like, Mr. Chairman, I'll go ahead and make a statement about the single subject issue.
Okay.
The proponents believe the single subject of the measure to be a increase in the state sales and use tax for the purpose of providing long-term services to persons with developmental disabilities. Ask that the board find a single subject.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Stedman? I don't think I have any. discussion of single subject? I don't have anyone else signed up to testify. Is there anybody who wishes to comment on the question of whether the measure complies with the single subject requirement? Seeing none, any discussion by the board? Ms. Eubanks?
I think that both 91A and 128, they both comprise a single subject, and the board should proceed to set a title for both of them. I would so move.
I suppose it's okay just to go ahead and do both together, since they're identical measures. The motion with respect to both 91A and number 128 is that the board find that they each comprise a single subject. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Then if we can turn to the staff draft. And Ms. Gomez has put the staff draft for number 91A on the board. I'm assuming the staff draft for number 128 is the same. But I think we can make sure they're the same. Whatever we set for one should be the other.
One, I suggest we work from 91 and then we'll move that it be set for 128 as well so that we don't have any.
Okay. Sounds good. Mr. Stedman, any comments about the staff draft?
Yes, we have a couple comments on the staff draft, and I also have a copy of the OSPB memorandum regarding the numbers to fill in the blank there in the first line of the staff draft. And because this is a phased-in increase, we would anticipate that both the $88.7 million figure and $186.1 million figure would be reflected in that opening section of the ballot title reflect that the $88.7 million figure would be in effect for one fiscal year, and a larger number would apply for fiscal years thereafter.
I thought the requirement of Tabor was that we reflect the amount of the tax increase for the first full state fiscal year. Ms. Eubanks, thank you.
And I'm just by chance looking at the language of Section 20 of Article 10. It does talk about where it's indicating that blank that needs to be filled in with a number. It says first or if phased in final full fiscal year dollar increase. And so I would read that as requiring the second figure, the $186.1 million, because that, I believe, is the once it has been fully phased in, the full estimate. And so I think we would only need to do the latter amount and not the half-year amount.
And if that's how the board's going to interpret the Constitution, I think that's your requirement. It raises a concern in my mind that the title then goes on to explain that there is a two-year implementation of this increase. If that creates any unstated dollar figure, opening and then a discussion of subsequent text.
In other words, should we put something after annually that indicates after fully phased in? Would that be appropriate, Ms. Eubanks?
I think we have total flexibility once you get past the mandatory language that's specified in the Constitution. Whether it's confusing, I mean, the whole point, as we've discussed earlier, of having that dollar amount, at least my understanding is that if tax revenues exceed that dollar amount, then Tabor requires the excess to be refunded. Obviously, you don't have that risk if in the first half year of implementation that the tax generates the $88.7 million, it's going to be below that number. So I think that, at least it's always been my understanding, that the number is supposed to indicate sort of the largest amount that so that folks know, because otherwise if you go the other way, then it sort of maybe voters are led to the impression that it's a lower amount if you do the 88.7. So I think that's why it was drafted to be the full fiscal year amount once it's phased in. Now, whether or not you want to explain that, I don't know that I'm so inclined to do so, just because you have a maximum amount. The fact that later on we explain that it's phased, the increase is phased in over a two-year period, I don't know that I feel that the voters are going to be confused with that. But if the board's inclined to do something to explain that after you get past the annually on line one, I think that's something we could talk about.
I'm not so inclined after hearing your explanation of it.
Mr. Chairman, my concern would be that if you say shall taxes be increased by $186.1 million annually, and then you go on to say increasing the rate by 0.1% in each of the next 2 years, I can definitely see an interpretation of that that suggests that each year's increment is $186 million. Not be accurate. But I think my preference would be to suggest that if there's some way to indicate that that is the maximum amount after full implementation, further explanation that could be offered.
Well, I guess I understand the point, and I although I hadn't thought about that interpretation.
I think it's the word annually there in that opening clause, and then each of the next 2 years, the operation of those two things together that's leading me to that actually misleading, inaccurate conclusion.
I mean, I was concerned that it's not annually because of the first year, but it is accurate. It is annually after the first year. Your concern is potentially worse than that, if that's a reasonable interpretation, is that it's a $186 million increase every year?
Yes.
I mean, okay.
And if I could, and Mr. Kneiser, we were just chatting about this. The fact is that, you know, Tabor requires the amount, you know, if phased in, the final full fiscal year. Now, whether or not once you get past annually, I think you still have to have annually because it's mandated in the Constitution. But, I mean, whether or not there could be some language to say once fully phased in, you know, or something like that, that might be helpful. I don't know that I feel that the risk is high there for confusion, but it may be possible to insert a few words that without explaining the whole phase in twice. I mean, I think we want to avoid trying to do that.
I mean, would it work to say state taxes shall be increased $186.1 million annually after full implementation by an amendment to the Colorado Revised Statutes?
That would help clarify this issue.
That's preferable. Like Ms. Eubank says, I don't want to have to end up saying this twice. I think, as she says, that we can, it's after the word annually, so we can say something that signals this is when the phase-in is done. I guess that suggestion would be, as Ms. Gomez is putting it on the board, inserting the words after full implementation.
Fully implemented?
After fully implemented.
I don't know which.
After full.
I don't know if it makes. If you want to look and see what it looks like, full implementation, see if we like that better.
think I like after full implementation better, but whatever you guys think.
Mr. Stedman, are you?
That I think that is sufficient to address the concern I had about that.
Helpful.
I'll go ahead and move those changes as indicated on the screen.
Second.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0.
And Mr. Chairman, we had two issues that we had with the proposed staff draft. On balance, we find it to be very accurate and acceptable. On line 7, the staff draft uses the word avoiding an impact on a prior voter approved revenue change. And we actually would suggest to the board that the word avoiding has a pejorative connotation that could be avoided by perhaps substituting the word preventing, a more neutral verb to use in that instance, prevents any impact on a prior voter revenue change. The other suggestion we would offer is to note, and this probably could happen at the end of line 11, strike the and on at the end of line 9. At the end of 11, change the period to a comma and add, and defining developmental disabilities to include autism, cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, and mental retardation. Actually offering to voters exactly, you know, what are the conditions that people would have benefit from this proposed tax increase. Helpful for them for understanding.
Okay.
There are other developmental disabilities besides those that could be subsumed if we didn't have that list?
The text of the measure includes a definition of the term that uses the phrase including but not limited to, but then those are the four specific conditions that are expressly.
But if you have the including but not limited to language, then putting those four in here would suggest to the people that those are the only four, whereas the measure actually says any.
Which is why we were suggesting to add that phrase, and defining developmental disability to include. I think that says it includes these things. I don't think there's a connotation there that it's an exclusive word. That it has that economy of words of not adding that phrase, including but not limited to.
Well, if we're gonna,
drafters like, but
if you use the but not limited to in the draft, shouldn't you use it in the title?
If that would be the board's preference, yeah, then that would more closely track the language of the proposal. It just seems like those not limited to doesn't necessarily add anything.
I'm not
include these things.
I have to say I'm not inclined to go there at all. I think I would leave it as is, but I don't feel strongly either way on that piece.
Yeah, I'm sort of leaning away from it, but I'm just trying to make sure I understand the concern. I mean, the definition of developmental disabilities, I mean, is this a major feature of the proposal? Is that definition a major feature? Is there anything surprising about the definition? I'm trying to work it through that analysis.
Well, I can help you with some of that. As far as is there anything surprising, no. And actually, you'll notice that there's a cross-reference statute within this definition that actually reads itself very similar to this definition. However, you know, given that the proposal is for a tax increase to provide a specific set of services to a specific population, helping people understand the population would help people understand the measure ballot this fall.
No.
So those would be the last.
I'm inclined to not include that in the title. But if we are going to include in the title, I think you have to include the but not limited to language.
Yeah.
I'm comfortable either way. I'm inclined not to include it, and I'm curious what the rest of the board thinks on that one.
Still kind of leaning away from it, but I don't know. While we think about that, Mr. Stedman, let me go back to your other.
Yes, and that was on line 7 to substitute the word preventing for avoiding.
And where the measure, just point me to the point part of the measure that that's referring to.
Oh, I was afraid you were going to ask that.
What you get for writing long measures.
This was not easy to draft with a lot of help where I had to start. I believe this is a reference to section 4 of the measure, where it exempts from the definition of state revenues that the state is authorized to retain and spend pursuant to 39.6. That is a prior, if I'm keying into the right section, that is a prior voter-approved revenue change. This is clarifying there's no interaction, venting that impact.
That indefinite because you don't know what prior revenue changes there are?
Help me understand, what do you, when you say indefinite?
Well, are there prior voter-approved revenue changes out there that we're worried about?
I believe this is one of the things that we see.
But maybe the only thing, because it has the cross reference, is 39.26.106.4, the provisions on REFC. I mean, is it specific only to that revenue voter-approved revenue change?
That's, and I'm not positive that I've keyed into the right part of the site. I hadn't really studied this before. I hadn't prepared to go into detail on this.
No, that's your reference.
Right.
See, this is the provision, the general implementation statutes for state fiscal policies. I'm not sure that provision is the one that is talking about prior voter approval. Because that's just saying that it's not counted as state revenues for TABOR purposes. It's not part of state fiscal year spending.
Which then is important. I'm sorry if I'm not able to give a good answer to this. I understand that preventing that impact on prior voter-approved changes. That has to do with fiscal year spending for purposes of REFC when time out.
So that it's not included
so that this is
in the amount that's used for the cap once the five-year timeout is done.
I think it's that 2477-102. Citation there in that definition. But again, I apologize, I didn't care to spend a lot of time on that section. Well,
I don't understand Section 4 at this point, but if what is in the title is accurate and it relates to Section 4, I'm not sure, going specifically to Mr. Stedman's suggestion, I don't know that I have a problem with using the word preventing instead of avoiding or some other word other than avoiding. I'm assuming for the moment that the drafter of the staff draft believe that that's an accurate representation of what the measure does, but I just don't see any difference between avoiding or preventing. But
And it really is just a preference around language. I can offer for you, Mr. Chairman, this proposal is based upon a measure that was drafted for an interim committee. And that this proposal does not emerge from that interim committee, but it will be drafted for their consideration. In the ballot title of that measure, this particular aspect was described in that proposed title written by this interim committee as assuring a neutral impact on prior voter-approved revenue change. That was, you know, the interim committee's preference on how to describe that. I think, you know, avoiding or preventing an impact is perhaps a little clearer than ensuring a neutral impact. Those are just some prior iterations of how this is going to work.
Well, I actually sort of like the idea of assuring a neutral impact, but...
I believe I have a copy.
And again, if that was accurate in the minds of the drafter for the interim committee bill.
Although in a way, I mean, if it's true, it's Section 4, I mean, that provision really doesn't on its face say this. I mean, it just excludes it from state revenues for purposes. And so I might be inclined to have a different phrase rather than this particular phrase based perhaps on my limited knowledge. I'm other than this initiative, I wasn't familiar with the bill that was done for the interim committee on DD, so...
And I do have a copy of that. I don't know if you're interested. Ensuring a neutral...
Insuring? Okay.
I mean, perhaps, I mean, you know, based on the language, it may be more accurate to say that it excludes, you know, the tax revenues from state revenues for purposes of paper or however you want to say it. I might be more comfortable saying that because I know that that's what that language says. I'm not sure in terms of the effect of this language, what exactly it does, other than it excludes it from state revenues.
Well, Ms. Eubanks, if you've got a better language, it sounds like you're going in the right direction. Rather than interpreting or judging, it's let's just say what the measure does.
And so perhaps on that phrase on line 7. Striking the language that begins avoiding all the way through revenue change and substituting excluding net revenue from the new tax from state revenues for purposes I don't know whether to do short form or
up paper.
I mean that's the easy way, but I don't know that.
Well, I think
for purposes
in the title, I think it probably is better to use the word Tabor.
I mean, you could say for purposes of the constitutional limitation on state fiscal year spending. I mean, without, you know, if you say Article 10.
Well, I think if you say Tabor, people know what you mean.
Well,
I don't know if everyone does. We do because we deal with it a lot. I don't know in terms of the norm. Common voter off the street, whether that would be meaningful or not.
And we should do constitutional limitations on spending.
Okay, so for purposes of... I think we'll need a the before constitutional. Limitation. On state fiscal year spending.
Chairman, if I may, the clause immediately preceding the one we're working on deals with also a Tabor issue permitting the state to retain and spend all revenues from the new tax, notwithstanding the state spending limit. So I think there's several things where we're using words that vary a little bit from how it's discussed just upstream, such as new tax rather than net revenue, or you know, notwithstanding the state spending limit, and here we're talking about limitation. It feels like this is starting to get a little redundant in here, and I don't know that we're making this any clearer or simpler. Frankly, I don't know that this issue about the definition of state revenues and prior voter-approved revenue change, I don't even know if it necessarily rises to the level of something that needs to be described in the title, and perhaps just getting rid of that avoiding clause altogether is another alternative that the board may consider.
I certainly think the way we've written it is indicative of what comes immediately before. All right.
Well, allowing, and this is just my interpretation, allowing the state to retain and spend, I mean, is what makes it a voter-approved revenue change. So when you're looking at the state spending limit, which is the previous year's fiscal year spending limit adjusted for inflation, population growth, plus voter-approved revenue changes. The first statement that's there, starting on line 5, that's what that statement's describing, that this is a voter-approved revenue change that you can always keep and spend, notwithstanding the constitutional spending limit. Now, why this measure is then excluding it from state revenues, I don't know. I'm fine if we don't even have the phrase in there. I just...
But you think it is different?
But I what the net effect is, whether it's viewed as a state... I mean, you can have voter-approved revenue changes that you don't have to exclude from the definition of state revenues, because they're still state revenues, but they're not subject to the limit, and you can always keep and spend them. But I might be inclined to then not to have anything in terms of taking out the language that we just... We still strike the phrase avoiding an impact, but perhaps not add any other language there.
That, I think, is
I'm okay with
acceptable solution.
I think I'd support that, just removing the clause altogether.
Okay. I'll move that we modify the title as set forth on the screen.
I'll second that. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Any other changes to the staff draft? No.
One other thing we'd ask you to consider is that definition of developmental disability.
Uh-huh.
Not inclined to.
I think what kind of pushes me the other way, just because the titles are supposed to be brief, and if it's not major feature, a definition I don't normally think of as a major feature, unless there's something surprising about it, or there's something that.
Then I would move.
I'm a single subject, right?
Yes.
Okay. I'd move the title as set forth on the screen, modifying the submission clause below to reflect the changes made in the title, and that we then apply the same title and submission clause to number 128.
Ms. Eubanks?
Before we do that, I've got two issues that I'd like to propose. Well, no, that's fine. And so I don't know whether you want to withdraw your motion.
I'll withdraw my motion
until we resolve it. And whether we do this or not. One, I was wondering whether it would be important to indicate when the tax starts and whether or not on line 5 after use tax, we might want to insert beginning on July 1st, 2009, just so folks know, have some time context of when in the rate's going to start being increased, whether that's important or not. The other thing that I wanted to get out there, which I do think is a major feature, is the fact that this measure prohibits the reduction in the level of appropriations in the long bill for long-term services for persons with DD. And I think that's an important feature, that it's basically freezing current appropriations, as I understand it, existing on the effective date of this measure, because and then this money, as I understand it, is supposed to be sort of on top of that. And
that's
the
correct.
Fact, I mean, in terms of mandating that that level of funding always be provided, I think is something that the voters need to know.
Okay. So, by the way, is that the right use tax that you were talking about?
Line 5, or has it moved down to line 6 now?
For the date, if we're going to insert the date, I think right there would be where we do it, and we could do it just by saying beginning on July 1, 2009. I put a comma, yep. I would move that change.
Second. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Ms. Eubanks.
And then in terms of the other issue, whether we want to just put it there at the end, which would require the striking of and on line 10. We're requiring to strike that and. And then on line 11, after disabilities but before the period, insert another semicolon and insert and prohibiting reduction of the level of state appropriations in the annual general appropriation bill. Appropriation,
bill.
Just singular, yeah, bill, existing on the effective date of this measure for long-term, that hyphenated, services for persons with developmental disabilities. I would move that change.
Second. Mr. Stedman, any comment?
I think we're generally supportive of this addition. Over a couple times and wondering if...
A shorter way?
Well, it's the reduction in the level of state appropriations and prohibiting reductions in of... And if, I mean, rid of one the...
In, okay.
Reductions in.
Got the first thought.
So,
right?
That reads just a little better.
Prohibiting reductions in or of, I don't know, but.
In, try that. Take out the of. I would modify my motion to reflect that change.
Objection.
No objection. So if there's no other discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. I think I want to raise one possibility now that we've lengthened the title. I wonder if we can shorten it. Line 6, the clause that reads exempting the new tax rate from the statewide sales and use tax limit. I want to raise the possibility of eliminating that clause. Does that really add anything? I mean, we've said that the tax rate is increased. Wouldn't the reader assume that that's actually going to be increased? They may not know about the limit.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I think there's a very good suggestion to get rid of that clause. I think you're right. It doesn't really add anything. The fact that we're able to raise this tax means that there is such a limit. We're within it, or we've worked around it with an exemption. Not really material.
And also the fact that the measure, I think, provides that that provision not take effect if a particular bill is enacted into law. And I know the General Assembly enacted the bill. I don't know if the governor's acted upon it. But
I don't believe that bill has been signed yet.
Okay, but I would assume that that may happen, and so that that won't even be an issue anymore by the time.
So that the limit will go away?
Yes, the aggregate state, local sales tax limit will be repealed.
Okay. Well, then I'll move striking that clause from the title. Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Mr. Blue, would you like to make a motion?
I'll have to think this through again, huh?
All right. I would move the title language as modified on the screen. Also move that language, that the submission clause be modified to reflect those changes, and that this title and submission clause also be substituted for the title and submission clause for initiative 128.
I'll second that. I think so. That's one motion to make to adopt these titles for 91A and 128, both the title and the ballot title and submission clause, which is the same as the title except in the form of a question. We would be done. That would complete action if that motion is adopted on both 91A and 128.
And you seconded
it. And I seconded it. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That concludes action on 91A and 128. And the time is 3:11 p.m. And I think I'd like to take about a 5-minute break, if that's okay. Okay, so actually maybe come back at 3:20.